You are listening to Counterterrorism After 9/11, a podcast series exploring how our field has changed in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Today, Counterterrorism After 9/11 is speaking to Frank Straub, Director of the Center for Mass Violence Response Studies at the U.S. National Police Foundation. 20 years ago, he was a first responder on the scene of the attacks in Lower Manhattan. Frank will be taking us through his experiences of the day and his perspective on how counterterrorism changed after the attacks. Interviewing him is Dr. Joanna Cook, an ICCT Senior Project Manager and Editor-in-Chief of the ICCT Journal.
Good morning, Mr. Straub. Thanks for joining us today. Can you please introduce yourself to our audience?
My name is Frank Straub, and I'm the Director of the National Police Foundation's Center for Mass Violence Response Studies. I joined the Police Foundation approximately 5.5 years ago after spending 30 years in federal, state, and local law enforcement in the United States. Early in my career, the first 6 years, I worked in the counterterrorism, counterextremism space with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Naval Investigative Service. I left and then joined the U.S. Department of Justice Inspector General's Office with the intent of working public corruption cases. In 1993, when the first attack on the World Trade Center happened, I did end up becoming involved in that investigation as a result of an individual that we had arrested on bribery charges. He had bribed immigration officials to get certain entry documents into the United States. And it turned out that he had gone to the mosque regularly in Jersey City, where most of the planning had taken place for the 93 bombing. And so after that bombing occurred, within hours, he called and told me that he needed to see me. He was incarcerated in a federal prison at the time. And we went and saw him. He provided some very important information and details to us. And we were able to connect him to the New York City Police Department, FBI, Joint Terrorist Task Force that I had worked on, as I mentioned, for about 6 years. And he was extremely helpful in that investigation. I also, once a number of the individuals were arrested and incarcerated, ended up getting back involved when one of the bombers made some accusations that some of the federal correction officers had used unnecessary force against him. And so not only did I lead that investigation, but also spent time with one of the bombers, interviewing him relative to that case. Stayed in my federal career and then had the opportunity to join the New York City Police Department. Ironically, on September 11th, I was on my way to the New York City Police Department to hand in my paperwork when the first plane hit the World Trade Center.
Where did your work take you after 9/11?
About 2 weeks after the 9/11 attack, I joined the NYPD as the Deputy Commissioner of Training, served in that position for about 6 months, and then the administrations changed in New York, and I was asked to help stand up the counterterrorism division in the New York City Police Department. After doing that, I went up to a small community about 30 miles north of New York, where I was the Public Safety Commissioner. I was there for about 9 years and then left and went out to Indianapolis, Indiana, as the public safety director for the city, and then out to Spokane, Washington, where I was the police chief. And then, as I said, I joined the National Police Foundation.
Where were you on the morning of 9/11? What do you remember from that day?
Yeah, so I won't go into all the gory details, but I want to give everyone a flavor for what it was like. So I was working about 6 blocks south of the World Trade Center complex. And as I said, I have been offered the position of Deputy Commissioner of Training with the New York City Police Department. And so I was actually in the elevator going down to head over to One Police Plaza, police headquarters, to hand in my final paperwork with the expectation that I was going to start the following Monday. While I was in the elevator, I felt the building shake, and fortunately, the elevator kept going and down in the right manner. And I got down to the ground floor and went outside, and everybody was looking at the World Trade Center at that point. I looked up at it. It was an absolutely crystal clear day, and it was clear that a rather large aircraft had hit the tower. And really, from my perspective, it was impossible that it was an accident for a plane, a commercial aircraft, to hit that building. Really took some precise flying, and again, it was very hard to imagine that it was anything less than intentional. And I think my work in the 93 case and just my work in the terrorism task force, really, I concluded pretty quickly that this was an intentional attack. So I went back upstairs to turn on the TV and find out what was happening with my colleagues. And shortly after getting upstairs and turning on the TV, the second plane hit. And again, the whole building shook. And so one of the other investigators that worked for me and I decided that we were going to go and see what we could do to help out. And so we walked out the back door of the building, and probably, and I can still see this today, the first thing we saw were body parts. Remember, we're six blocks south of the building, and you know, all kinds of human tissue, to the point that we had to be very intentional to step over it in making our way up to the towers. We certainly witnessed many of the people who were jumping from the towers or hanging from windows that had been blown out. When we got to the towers, we came across a friend of Pete. He's the gentleman that I was with, a retired New York City detective. He knew the captain who was with a group of firefighters, and they were going into the building. So we had a brief exchange with them. Probably 10 minutes later, the first building started to come down. We were fortunate enough to be able to get across the street and behind a building. The towers came down, and once we could see, because as you can imagine, there was tremendous amounts of debris in the air, we went back over to where the tower was. I think at that point it was incomprehensible that that building had come down. It defied logic. I had, you know, growing up in those buildings, I had been in a meeting in that specific tower the day before. And interestingly, we saw a firefighter crawling out of the rubble on his hands and knees. And miraculously, this New York City fire lieutenant had survived the collapse of a 110-story building. We were able to pull him out of the wreckage and connect him with a medical personnel. We then went up to, not that it was very far, to the second tower. And we were trying to direct people away from the building. People don't really recognize that on 9/11, we believe about 25,000 people that were working in and around the towers by evacuating them. We always focus on the people who lost their lives, and rightfully so, but it also probably was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, rescue mission in New York City history also. So we were doing that, and a group of New York City emergency service officers, they're kind of a combination of SWAT officers, tactical officers, and medics. They share both skills and rescue personnel. And so I had trained a number of individuals, officers in a group that we met up with several years ago when I was with the State Department and NCIS. And so they were suiting up to go into the building. We were going to go in with them, and they didn't have enough Scott air packs. And so they said, look, you know, we think it's probably better if you guys stay out here. You know, there's all kinds of stuff in the building. And so they went in, we stayed out, and that in part saved my life. We were right next to the building. And the building started to shake, and we knew now what was going to happen based on the first building. And so we started running north. We got probably about half a block away, and were able to get under a piece of fire apparatus, Pete, myself, and a firefighter. As we were running, we could feel the building collapsing. We could feel all kinds of stuff hitting us in the back. It kept getting darker and darker and darker. When we were under the fire truck, it got completely black. I mean, it was a total absence of light. It was the blackest I've ever been in. It's not even like going in a closet and closing the door. There literally was no light whatsoever. We could smell and breathe. I'm not sure what it was. It smelled like jet fuel. The fire apparatus that we were under got lifted up, and came back down. Fortunately, the wheels held, and so we weren't crushed. when light started to return, we came out from under the fire truck, and pretty much everything was on fire. There were police vehicles on fire, fire apparatus on fire. There had been just a tremendous amount of paper that had blown out of the Trade Center that was on the ground, and that was all burning. So it was kind of like coming out into hell, to be perfectly honest with you. Some of the ammunition that were in was in some of the police vehicles started to explode, go off. And Pete immediately grabbed me and asked if I was okay. And I was like, you know, probably about as okay as you are, right? what I didn't realize is that my whole back was covered with blood and other fluids. And it turned out that one of the people that was running behind us didn't make it under the fire truck. And so the initial thought was that I was hurt. It turned out I was fine. I ended up with two scratched corneas, but other than that, I was okay. So we stayed and tried to help as much as we could. For the next couple of weeks, I went back intermittently and worked on what has been referred to as the pile, trying to help. We thought initially to rescue people, but really to recover remains. And then on October 1st, I joined the NYPD as the Deputy Commissioner of Training.
For many people that work in the field of counterterrorism, 9/11 remains one of these foundational moments for guiding the way their careers have gone forward and really the topic that they have focused on. How have the events of 9/11 impacted your own career path?
I think people sometimes probably dismiss it as a cliche phrase, right, that we'll never forget. But that's incredibly important, right? This was the largest attack, terrorist attack on U.S. soil. You know, more than 3,000 people were killed. A number of my friends and colleagues were killed. But, you know, we, and I would say we, not just the U.S., but the world, I don't know that we appreciated enough after the 1993 bombing and some of the events that followed that and then the 9/11 attack, the shift that had occurred in terrorism, right? We tend to be, I think, oftentimes too slow, and too myopic in our focus. And, you know, for an example, the New York City Police Department, when I got there, my first mandate was to reimagine, reinvent, if you will, counterterrorism training for, at that point, a 52,000 person organization. The training at that point was really still focused on the days of the Weather Underground and Black Liberation Army and the FALN and so on and so forth. And despite the 93 attack, there really was little focus and attention being paid on the threat that we saw manifest itself. So really the first job I had in many ways was to redesign that training. And we had to do it very quickly, right? Because it wasn't just the attack. We now were pretty convinced, and the intelligence suggested that there would be follow-up attacks, particularly on the New York City subway. And so I was charged with developing what we call roll call training for all of our uniform and civilian staff, again, about 52,000 people, and getting it out there as quickly as possible. You have to also put this in the context of you have a department that's been devastated by this event, right? And we lost one person from the police academy. And so I had my staff was grieving. We also in the adjoining the way the police academy used to be, it adjoined a police precinct, and we lost one of the two female officers who were killed on 9/11. And she was the wife of another person that worked in the academy. So this was very personal. And the video unit is where the officer came from, but yet the video unit was essential to creating this training. And despite the pain and the sorrow, my staff rallied. And in 4 months, we produced video training elements that were informed by law enforcement officials and some of the best scientists in the world around a potential attack on the subway and what that might look like and what officers could do to prepare for that. We looked at biological and chemical weapons. We looked at dirty bombs. And really, probably the biggest issue was, what do we do with a suicide bomber? We had never contemplated that, nationally or locally. And how did that fit into use of force, and how did that fit into the U.S. Constitution in terms of, in many regards, having to make a decision as to whether you would preemptively use force versus use force in response to a threat, right, against an officer or the community. So we developed those modules, but right in the middle of that, anthrax hit. So we had an actual chemical attack in the United States. It turned out not to be a foreign attack, right, by every indication. But we had to wrestle with that. So there were these initial responses, right? How do we how do we find body parts, right? How do we find belongings from people? How do we deal with the families and relatives and have any semblance of family reunification? How do you process the impact, the trauma that this event had on New York City and the nation, but also on 52,000 people? Mm-hmm. But they have to keep going to work every day. Yeah. We don't get to take a break. And then how do we really think about this new threat environment and how do we respond to it?
What have been the most significant changes from the events of 9/11 related to policing and training for police in mass incident cases like this, or where terrorism was suspected?
I think we had missed a lot of indicators that were coming out of specific communities in the United States that had been radicalized. We had deficient intelligence sharing at both the federal level and between the federal government and local law enforcement, right? The United States is very unique, right? We don't have federalized law enforcement. We have something like 18,000 different police agencies at the state and local level. And then we have the federal construct of law enforcement. And really, we were still very much in the beginning stages of integration of federal and local law enforcement through terrorism task forces. And so I think we missed a lot of the indicators. We didn't shift gears, I don't think, well enough and quickly enough after the 93 bombing. And as I said, you know, some of the events, the USS Cole and some of the other things that should have been really kind of jumping out at us as warning signs that this was going to happen, right? And I think we've done the same thing with domestic terrorism. We really missed this undercurrent of nationalist movements and white supremacy in the United States, and the fact that it was becoming so powerful and so impactful and so energized that a large group of people would try to overthrow the United States Congress. And obviously there were political issues and political rhetoric that influenced that. But I think one of the major lessons, right, for all of us that are in this space is not to be myopic, but really to challenge ourselves every day to be thinking about what is the current threat environment? And what does that threat environment suggest to us is necessary in terms of response? Both at a local level and a national level and an international level.
And when we're looking at policing within the U.S., so domestic policing, we're looking at a 20-year period now. A lot has changed in 20 years. But what would you say have been the biggest changes, the biggest evolutions in the way policing is conducted in relation to terrorism and the means to counter it domestically? Whether this is taking into account, for example, the online space, the interaction between international and domestic considerations, what would you say are the biggest issues that have really shaped and impacted how policing is imagined in this counterterrorism space domestically within the U.S.?
So I think initially, right, we had a very strong quasi-militaristic response, right? So we really saw the growth or the reinvigoration of tactical teams, right? In New York City, there were special units that were created to protect critical infrastructure, major tourism spaces, and that was done with a show of force, right? And that happened throughout the country. We also saw a very energized intelligence gathering process. We realized that it was necessary to go out and hire, in New York, I'll speak to, individuals who spoke a variety of languages, both Middle Eastern languages, but also, much more diversity in terms of language skills and abilities. We also realized that we had to really engage, not only, persons from the Middle East, but, really new immigrants more broadly. And so that really created the whole countering violent extremism process in terms of trying to get members of those communities to collaborate with law enforcement at both the local and federal level to identify individuals that were either at risk or potentially were being radicalized. Certainly, we saw the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, some positives and negatives to that. I think it's still an area of debate as to whether that's successful. we saw the growth of the terrorism task forces throughout the country, which has, I think, been incredibly important in terms of aligning local and federal level resources and intelligence sharing. We also saw the development of fusion centers throughout the United States, both at the local and federal level, and combined intelligence centers, which have been incredibly important. But as many things in the U.S., they ebb and flow, right? And so we also saw very visceral public reactions to some of this, both the tactical end and the intelligence end, and the countering violent extremism piece. And to some degree, it is because we're building the airplane at the same time we're flying it, right? We're struggling to figure out how do we deal with this threat environment, both current and emerging. And so sometimes in the process of building the plane, while you're trying to get from point A to point B, maybe you're over aggressive in certain areas, or you're overly aggressive in certain communities. And so we've had to, and I think this is important, right? Again, we've had to tweak our responses and our strategies. But I would argue that that's something that needs to be done on a very regular basis and a continuing basis, right? so I think that's a large part of it. I think we are doing much better, both nationally and internationally. I think we still are challenged by cyberspace, if you will, particularly at the local level. I don't think that the majority of police agencies are conversant in social media. They're not conversant in terms of being able to use it to gather intelligence. And we saw that really in the post-George Floyd series of mass demonstrations, that police departments really had no understanding or appreciation of the community sentiment that had built up against the police, and then the level at which social media was used to organize demonstrations and to intentionally incite violence within demonstrations directed at the police and directed at communities. And so I think that's an area that we really need to focus on, is the whole social media piece.
In relation to policing and either counterterrorism specifically or some of the broader work on countering violent extremism, what are some of the areas beyond social media and the online space that are still areas that could use further development?
I'm gonna go backwards. I think the biggest challenge that we face, and I believe we're going to continue to face, is how do you carry on effective counter-extremism, counter-terrorism operations in a democracy? And how do you do that in a way that protects, in our country, the First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, also the right to bear arms, in a way that protects local communities and protects the nation, again, without violating those rights. And I think that's a struggle that we're going to continue to have. There clearly is no easy answer to this. I think the challenge of having 18,000 very different police departments and a federal law enforcement environment and trying to get those to align is also very, very challenging. So those are the challenges. I think what are we doing right? And obviously the social media piece that I talked about. I think we are doing a better job of working together. I think we are listening to the communities that we serve and recognizing the impact that we have when we engage in CBE work. And I think that's helping the process. I think it's helping us build trust in communities where we need that trust in order to disrupt radicalization efforts.
For students that look at countering terrorism and countering violent extremism, they see this perhaps as a concept that's been around for a long time. But actually, countering violent extremism is a much more recent concept, and it's one that really developed out of the period following 9/11. Can you expand more on the relationship of policing communities working together in the countering violent extremism space?
Well, I think it's critical, right? We can't do the work that we do to protect our communities and our country unless we do it in collaboration with the community, right? And this goes beyond terrorism and extremism, right? It really goes to targeted violence, mass violence more generally. We need the community to feel comfortable when they see something that suggests concerning behavior or is concerning behavior, reporting that to the police, recognizing that the police will, in fact, take appropriate action and resolve the issue. And we would hope that the vast majority of issues can be resolved through early intervention and don't even have to end up in the criminal justice system. I think it's also the community's obligation to tell us what we're getting right and what we're getting wrong versus waiting until we've done something that really is so egregious that now it has caused a crisis, right? And so I think that open and honest dialogue really is essential to building effective policies, practices, and strategies. And we can't do it without the community. I mean, it's really that simple because it's the community we're trying to protect. It's the community that really, at the end of the day, has the greatest insight. And so we need to be able to draw on that insight, both in the development stage and the implementation stage, but also in the evaluation stage to make sure that we're not having adverse impacts or violating people's rights in the process of trying to prevent terrorism or extremism or more mass violence more generally.
Countering violent extremism has been increasingly recognized to include multiple actors, and police are certainly best positioned to lead some of this work as well. From your perspective, how have you viewed this process in terms of working with different community partners and really trying to find that balance of actors coming together in this space where police, again, may have a role to play, but not necessarily always the leading role?
Yeah, so we did a program in Boston, a CBE program that was funded by the Department of Homeland Security a few years ago. And it was with the Somali community. And I chose that word with versus in, right? That we really needed the Somali community to be a part of it. And so the premise of what we did was based on building relationships and working through stereotypes between young Somali youth and the Boston Police Department and the Boston Transit Police. So we engaged a nonprofit organization that I had worked with for many years around reducing youth violence by building these relationships of trust. And so we used that program as the premise for our CVE work. And so we brought over the course of the year, probably about 100 young women and men into meetings, focus groups, if you will, with Boston Police officers. And the whole idea was to really, as I said, break through stereotypes, right? There's tremendous lack of understanding in police departments generally, I would say in American communities generally, about the Somali community, their culture, their practices, their religious beliefs, their food, all of the, why do they wear the clothes they wear, right? And so, you know, having that conversation and giving these young women and men the opportunity to really increase the knowledge that these officers had of Somali communities and customs and beliefs, but also giving the officers an opportunity to explain to these young women and men why they wear the equipment they do and why they act in certain ways, and then going back and forth in terms of, well, if you do this, this is why I do this, right? And really getting them to talk about that was incredibly impactful. And so we had these sessions, we did team building exercises, we had sports activities, we had community barbecues. And what we found over time, and we had found this in our violence prevention work, is that slowly but surely parents started to show up, and an aunt and uncle would show up, or a big brother or sister would show up, because there was this kind of energy and kind of word of mouth in the community that something kind of different was happening here, right? That these were, in essence, human interactions that went beyond what somebody wore or what their role was, but they were people conversing, right? And that became a very powerful tool. It was recognized by DHS as one of, you know, the 10 model programs in that space. And so I think it really gets to the heart of much of this work really boils down to human relationships, building trust at the individual level and the organizational and community level, and really working through these barriers in terms of understanding. And I think when that happens, maybe some of these communities don't feel like they're disenfranchised, right? That they're isolated from the broader community. Maybe it creates these opportunities to build bridges. And I think what we find is that when people feel isolated, when they feel like they're being treated as something different and something other, and they're pushed away, that only reinforces, right, in some cases, their perceived grievances, their anger, their frustration. And so when you have those emotions building up, particularly in communities that have been highly traumatized, it becomes just this potential breeding ground for extremist ideology to ferment and to take root. And so I think it becomes incredibly important to break down those barriers, to break down isolation, to create effective avenues of communication. And not that anybody should give up who they are, right? We don't want that. What we want is a community that respects and recognizes the differences of the various people that live in their community, because if we do that, then we have stronger communities.
Frank, when we look at the last 20 years since 9/11, a lot has changed. But what would you say is the biggest lesson learned, particularly from the view of policing in these last 20 years? And when we're looking at the threat landscape today, particularly in the US, how or where should these lessons be applied today?
I think the lesson is that we have to remain ever vigilant. And regardless of what other challenges are out there, whether it's COVID or something else, we can't lose sight of the fact that there are people in the world, there are people in the United States that are intent on committing acts of violence, that are committed to disrupting our democracy, that are intent on advancing really a different ideology across the world. And so we have to remain vigilant. We have to remain committed to this very, very important work. And I think when we let our guard down, that's when we see, sadly, attacks like 9/11. And so we have to be ever vigilant. We have to be committed. We have to take on a whole of community approach. And we have to maintain that whole of community approach, both in challenging times and in times when it's really working. But I think that's the biggest lesson, is we can't lose focus. We always have to be thinking about what's next, right? Is there another group emerging? Is there a new threat emerging? How are we going to counter that? And so we have to be in this process of risk identification and risk mitigation versus crisis response.
When you look at the domestic environment in the US, what does this specifically look like to you? What are some of the concerns that really come to the forefront of your mind?
I think we have some very highly traumatized and disenfranchised communities and groups in the US. We have people that are part of white nationalist organizations, white supremacist organizations, who clearly feel very isolated, very disenfranchised. They have a number of grievances, whether they're real or imagined, they have grievances. And I think we have to pay attention to trying to figure out what that dynamic is, what that trauma is, and how do we bring those disparate groups to the table, right? Similarly, we have members of communities of color that have very equal feelings of trauma and isolation and disenfranchisement. And so we have to really recognize right now that we have, I think, highly traumatized groups and communities. We have a very fragmented situation. We have a very volatile situation. And we really need to be concentrating on how do we tone down the political rhetoric at a national level, at a local level? How do we identify members of these disparate groups? And how do we find a common language and strategy that allows us to break down these barriers that have developed, particularly over the past 5 to 6 years, and become so energized and so volatile, so that we can re-engage these individuals, we can figure out where their grievances are and what their grievances are and try to ally some of those grievances. I think that that is not just in the United States. I think it's across the world. And we really have to think about a multi-pronged strategy that we're going to use to not only protect our communities and our nation, but to address the issues of trauma and isolation so that we can decrease, I think, opportunities for radicalization and energizing of these various groups.
Is there a final message you'd like to leave with our audience today, Frank?
Yeah, I think, you know, the work that you're doing, Joanna, and your colleagues and persons that are engaged in this space, right, from a research perspective, and for the students that you're mentoring, right, and others are mentoring, I think that's incredibly important, right, because we need empirical evidence to support the work we're doing. You know, sometimes we tend to go off and we respond with, you know, the cliche term of knee-jerk reactions. And maybe if we slowed the response down a little bit and really tried to understand what the data suggested, our strategies would be longer lasting and more impactful. So I greatly appreciate and applaud the work of you and your colleagues and the students that are interested in this field, because really they're the future, right? And I think if we can train them with a very humanistic strategy as the baseline from which we operate, we get folks to understand trauma and isolation, and we use that as the foundation from which we develop our strategies, I think we can go a long way in protecting our communities. And so I think this 20th anniversary is a very good time to pause, to think about where we are and where we need to be, to remember what happened, because we shouldn't live in history, but we should certainly recognize aspects of history that give us the opportunity to inform our current decision-making and approach, as well as our approach to future challenges and opportunities.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Counterterrorism After 9/11, a new podcast series from the International Center for Counterterrorism. For more counterterrorism insights, please find us at icct.nl. Stay tuned for more episodes of Counterterrorism After 9/11.